6th, 2011, regular meeting of the San Luis Coastal Unified School District. The board met in closed session. We had a conference with our labor negotiators regarding negotiations with CSEA, Confidential Employee Management, Education, Educators Council, the San Luis Coastal Teachers Association, and the SEIU. Do we have a consensus on the order of business? Okay. Then let's go ahead and let's move to item number one, which is, we'll move to approval of minutes. Would somebody like to make a motion for the approval of the minutes for the August 16th board meeting?
I have a couple of corrections. Do you want to get a motion first and then?
Why don't we get a motion first and then we'll work on corrections? Somebody like to do that?
I'll move approval pending some corrections.
Okay. We'll have a motion and need a second. Mr. Quisenberry? So it's been moved by Mr. Millar and seconded by Mr. Quisenberry. Now, how about discussion?
Okay. I noticed that on first page under consensus on the order of business, no changes were made to the order of the agenda. And then on the next page, there was a change to the order of business because we moved the folks up who were here on the Pacheco School traffic issue up. And then secondly, Mr. Millar did not share that state revenues were falling short of projections. And even if I'd known that, I didn't share it, but Mr. Miller did.
So. Okay.
And that's the only ones I noticed.
All right. Is there any other discussion on the minutes? So, seeing none, Mrs. Holmes, did you catch those? I'm sure you did. Then all in favor of the minutes as amended by recommendation by Mr. Millar, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carries 6-0.
I will state that I abstained since I was not.
I'm sorry. Carries 5-0 with one abstention.
Thank you.
All right. Excuse me for just a second here. All right. Let's move on then to correspondence. The board did not receive any correspondence. So we'll move on to public comment. We have one request to speak in public comment. Odile Irel, please. Okay.
Good evening. Tonight I come to talk about planting on Pacheco school grounds. It is something that is non-controversial, cheap, and good for everyone, so I hope you will listen to what I propose. When measures were written to mitigate the environmental impact of Pacheco over the neighborhood, they included a visual effect paragraph written in the future, therefore binding. By this I mean the word shall was used, not the word should. I now read from the text of the mitigation measures. The proposed parking lot shall be depressed as low as feasible below Ferrini Street and appropriate screen planting installed on both Ferrini and Cerro Remoldo streets to substantially screen cars in the lot. Cerro Remoldo does not have a parking area, but Ferrini has a drop-off that brings many cars to it every day. This drop-off has not been depressed as it was supposed to be, nor has it been screened. Mr. Guy added three trees to the large pepper tree that was already there, and this is good, but trees do not hide cars and do not prevent people from going back and forth between the street and the drop-off. It is too late to depress the drop-off, but it is not too late to add plants. The school needs to plant about four fast-growing plants, such as Pittosporum, between each tree. This would make a total of 12 plants. In a few years, these plants will have made a hedge that hides the cars and increases safety by making it impossible to weave back and forth between the drop-off and the street. The sprinkling system is already installed along the drop-off, so the cost would be limited to buying a few plants. Other planting ought to take place around the new portable. I listened to the recording of the August 16 school board meeting, and I heard Mr. Guy talk about planting and managing the noise from the air conditioning, but I don't know what he has in mind. I recommend planting along the portable on the Ferrini side to hide it from the street, as well as in other areas where the portable might be visible from the neighboring houses.
Please do.
For those of you who don't know me, I'm Haley Ramos. I am now a senior at Morro Bay High School, and I am now the ASB president at Morro Bay High School. So I'm enjoying my last year at Morro Bay. I'm going to start off with the past events that have happened on campus so far during the year. We started off with registration for Morro Bay on August 17th, and that went fairly well. Everyone showed up, took their picture, registered for classes, got their schedules, paid off fines, and everything like that. The following weekend, ASB had their annual retreat at my house. It's a gathering that the class has every year to bond, talk about the activities coming up during the year, and have really good food. The next week, on the first Friday of the school year, we had our first dance of the year, the Welcome Back Dance, and we charged $1 for students who had ASB and $3 without, and we banked $472.35. Someone must have tipped us 35 cents. I don't know where that came from. And with that, roughly around 420-plus students probably attended, and that was mostly freshmen because high school dances are better than middle school dances, and they enjoyed themselves very much. The next Tuesday, we had our Welcome Back Assembly, and that involved having the new school teachers and the old school teachers compete in a dance-off with each other, which involved our principal, Mr. Andrus, and our new dean, Mr. Black, in a showdown of disco, which had very good response from the senior section of the gym. And one teacher commented that it was the best assembly I have seen in my 25 years at Morro Bay.
What was, just before you go on, so was Mr. Andrus in his leisure suit?
No.
Oh, too bad.
He was in his normal wear, but he proceeded to get down and do the coffee grinder after he pointed. So it was very nice. We did not get it on film, but it was very entertaining, and it was, honestly, I think it was probably the best assembly I've ever seen in my entire life. It was very nice.
Question from one of our other board members. So who was the victor?
Oh, old school by far. Definitely. For any of you who know Mr. Bedrigian, he had to do ballet. And he brought in his old English swords props, and he trumped the new English teacher. So they all did fairly well for only knowing the dance steps about 3 days in advance. So, and some of them only knew that they were going to be dancing in front of the entire school 20 minutes before. So they were happy about doing that. And then our football team participated in their first scrimmage on September 3rd, and they went down south and participated in a scrimmage involving four other teams, and it was just a scrimmage, not a game. And they played 34 plays, and in the 34 plays, the Pirates scored 11 touchdowns. Go Morro Bay. And that's all for the past events on campus. And for upcoming events, this Thursday, our clubs are having Club Rush, and clubs basically advertise themselves to gain prospective students to join clubs such as Key Club, Jew Crew, Red Cross Club, all the other clubs that we have on campus, everything. We have very diverse clubs at Morro Bay. And our first home football game is this Friday. Kickoff is at 7:30. I've provided all of you with season passes to every single sporting event at Morro Bay and a schedule for the football season. So I hope to see you all there. And our football team is also having a fundraiser selling T-shirts similar to the Seattle Seahawks I Am the 12th Man t-shirts. So check those out. They're only $10, and all the proceeds go to our football team. So if you're a Morro Bay fan and you're not slanted to any other school, purchase one. So yeah, 7:30, we're playing Carpinteria. It's not a league game, it's just for fun. And homecoming week is the 10th to the 15th, and the theme is a secret at this point, so I can't tell you. And new things to ASB, the 2011-2012 leadership class is now under the advisory of Laura Van Zee. Mrs. Van Zee has taught ASB at SLO High and is also a history and government teacher. She's my AP government teacher now. She's awesome. Our class has openly accepted this great change, seeing that our previous advisor, Mr. Scott Scaldi, is now a teacher on special assignment at Laguna. And even though we miss him very, very much, we have
heard great reviews from the teachers that they really enjoyed the assembly. We had our first football game last week, which was very close, but unfortunately we lost by 5 points against Kingsburg in Kingsburg. And this week we play Dos Pueblos. Also, at the last week of September, the 26th to October 1st, I believe, we are having homecoming week, where we will have many spirit days, and the theme is music through different genres. So each class is a different genre of music. And we have breakfast club on that Wednesday where the students invite their favorite teacher out to breakfast. And we have, on Friday, we have rallies and assemblies followed by a parade through downtown ending in Mission Plaza. And then we have a football game that evening. And also next Saturday, that following Saturday, we are having the homecoming dance, which will be a lot of fun, and that'll be our first dance of the year. So, yeah.
Thank you very much. And as always, we want you to know that we really value your coming here. And one of the things we do think is so great, if you can do it, we understand that you have other pressing things to do, but know that if there are items on the agenda that you wish to speak on, that as student board members, you can stay here and absolutely provide your input and your comments. And we do pay very close attention to those things. Otherwise, know that it's okay for you to go too, and that we understand that you probably have a boatload of homework already. So thank you both very much, and we welcome you here, and we look forward to hearing from you.
Great.
Dr. Prater.
Thank you. Very, very little to report out of Sacramento in the last month. They've been on leave, on vacation, and they've recently been called back and have started work on bills. But none of them are impactive or of major concern. I think the thing that education has to watch carefully is the trigger points that will become known as the revenues of November are reported in mid-December. Sales taxes, income taxes, property taxes, all of the basic tax levels. And to determine whether or not the budget that was constructed by the state used correct assumptions or not. If their assumptions are not correct, and they don't meet the standard that is in place for the budget bill, then the cuts to education will be determined, and they can be as much as $260 per student, and they will be mid-year cuts, and they will be known sometime in January. So we'll watch very carefully about the revenues that the state is reporting out from November, as that's the standard for which the cuts will be measured from. Other than that, not a whole lot going on.
Russell, just and those cuts, if they were to occur to us, will be in the fair share of pain category?
There is nothing in the bill language that says that, but we assume that, as it has been in past histories, past years. Basic aid districts are always hit with some fair share of pain.
And how, and just briefly, how is that What's the mechanism for that being done?
Essentially, it's to take back. Since we don't get any revenue, we don't get any unrestricted revenues from the state, what they do is they attach the monies they give us for basically the restricted categorical type programs up to and including, this time they're talking about special ed being a revenue source that they would short in order to meet our obligation. So they've hit us awfully hard to the extent that our basic categorical programs are being zero funded by the state, and they're getting into home-to-school transportation and other basic programs that aren't necessarily categorical in order to meet the level of take-backs that they've imposed upon basic aid districts. So it's starting to get very severe for us, too.
Well, I will report on school opening. So nothing nearly as exciting as what we heard from Haley and Tessa, I don't think. But we finished our ninth day of school today, so 171 to go, and it seemed like, from all accounts, a very smooth opening. We had the inauguration of our transitional kindergarten program. That's one of the most exciting things of the new school year. So both at Los Ranchos Elementary School and Monarch Grove Elementary School, we have started ahead of the game the idea of a two-year kindergarten program for those students who will be turning five between Seppel and Greg Halfman, continuing to wear multiple hats and being the principal of Pacific Beach High School. Our class sizes look very good. We had a targeted capping our K-3s at 25-1. I'm happy to report that our averages are below 23-1. Our 4th through 6th grade averages are below 28-1, as are our 7th through 12th grade classes. That doesn't mean there aren't anomalies here and there of large classes, but in truth, we have 13 combo classes in the entire elementary ranks, which is the lowest I've ever seen it. We have 150 elementary classes in our school district, and that's not counting special ed, just 150 regular classroom classes, and only 13 of them are combo classes, so that's nice. As far as overall enrollments, we are up about 100 students, so we are experiencing some growth. We seem to have hit that plateau over the last couple years, and we can expect to see some moderate growth because all of that growth, virtually all of that growth, is at the elementary level, which means we also have more students in special education, more students, more EL students, more students of socioeconomically disadvantaged. So the issues that we face and the at-risk students we face continue to be there. All of our new elementary teachers were trained in a program, a concept, really, of the first 20 days. So we're trying to make sure everyone who comes into our district really gets the tools they need to get up and running. We have a large number of teachers in our BITSA program, beginning teacher support and assessment, so we'll have a lot of mentoring going on this year. And except for just a couple little holes here and there in the student services arena and the fact that we will need to start staffing for our preschool program, which we will begin this year, but we're kind of putting all our ducks in a row on that one, we are staffed and ready to go, and it seems like a very smooth opening.
And to round out the superintendent's update, I would like to take a moment and just speak to what I think is a great opportunity for any governance team, any board member, if you will. And it's through the California School Boards Association. And I've known about this program for years. I just have been slow to warm up to it and understand it fully. And just like in our school sites, we encourage our principals and the staff to develop professional learning communities. The same thing applies at the governance level for trustees. And I think it's a wonderful concept. I think it's a wonderful training opportunity for school board members. And so I did some homework, and I spoke to the lead of the California School Board Association Masters in Governance trainer, and her name is Stephanie Goodlett, and she basically agreed that if we did a countywide proposal to pull in throughout the county, which would include northern Santa Barbara County and southern Monterey County, of all the school districts in that area, she would do a regional California School Board's Master's in Governance certification program here at the County Office of Education. And so the price is reasonable, but I want to talk really about what's involved. I'm familiar with a school district in the Bay Area called the Walnut Creek School District, and every one of their board members is certified through the Master's in Governance training. And let me just explain basically what it is. It's 9 modules, and it's conducted over a 2-year period. And what they talk about are right over here to the right-hand side where it says program modules. And so you could imagine if we could get 25 board members to participate in this program here on the Central Coast, they'll come out over a 2-year period. So the first year is 4 full days, and the second year is 5 full days. And so the modules look like this. Foundations of Effective Governance, so examining the roles and responsibilities of governance team. So they basically work through that piece. The second piece is setting direction, which we've done really well, I believe, in our district. The other one is human resources and understanding the board's role in supporting that. Policy and judicial review. As you know, setting policy is a huge piece to effective governance. Student learning and achievement. We're speaking of that more and more every day, and that is a huge commitment to be to drive that as a school board member. School finance, collective bargaining, community relations, and advocacy, as well as governance. So basically working.
First of all, I wanted to thank the board for their continued support of summer school, and certainly remind everybody that summer school is actually a great bargain. If you look at it from the secondary perspective, the cost per credit is extremely reasonable. And at the elementary level, Blake will share some of our progress. You see an intensive program that can really produce results at a very reasonable price. You recall that several years ago we began offering the summer school principalship to one of the in-district teachers, the idea being that it would give teachers who aspired to be an administrator a chance to kind of test out the job and see if they still aspired to that or whether they thought better of it. And this year, we were very, very fortunate to have Blake Bristol. Usually the first year, they kind of get the lay of the land and figure some things out. And the second year, they really get a chance to try it out. Well, Blake hit the ground running. He really will be an outstanding administrator. I tried to convince him to move in that direction quickly, but as sometimes happens, people who are outstanding teachers have a hard time leaving the classroom. Take it away, Blake.
So I wanted to thank you all for having me here tonight. Thank you to Dr. Prater and Mr. Robinette and Mr. Miller and Kim and Greg and Jackie and Janet and Amy. There were, I don't know how many people we had working through to get the summer school program running and have it to be a successful program. One of the things that we looked at, if we can, there we go, number of students that we had a total of 963 students run through the summer school program. Numbers are up on the board there. The Del Mar and C.L. Smith had about a little over 500 students total. Morro Bay and San Luis High School had in the 450 range. And then we also had 4 schools that ran kind of their own site-run summer school programs. We let them kind of tailor the program to best fit the needs of their students. There was a little bit of oversight on my part, but the principals at those schools, for the most part, staffed the staffing and picked the students that would attend summer school. And so we had almost 400 students that were through the summer school program at the other 4 schools. Some of the staffing, we had 24 teachers, 16 instructional aides, 4 secretaries, 6 volunteer site principals, 2 crossing guards. Little side note, the volunteer site principals. We've kind of developed a partnership with Cal Poly's master's degree program in educational leadership. And we were able to have six of them volunteer their time over the summer. And they came in and acted as the site principal at each of the district-run summer school sites. And having them at each site allowed me to be a little more flexible so I could concentrate more on the instructional program, staffing issues, look a little bit at the bigger picture items. And they were in charge of the day-to-day running of the school and the day-to-day discipline actions. Although there was I don't think there a day went by where there wasn't a phone call from one of them saying, how do we do this here? Of the six, there were all six of them were from out of the district. So it was a nice way to be able to get them into a position with it. It's going to allow them to grow also. There we go. We're going to run through a few slides here. The slides will show the average score of a student in each of the performance level categories. So in the below basic category for first grade English language arts, the average student started off the year at about a 38% on this pretest that Darla Batistic and I put together through the Instructional Services Department. At the end of the summer, the average below basic student was at about a 54%. So we saw some incredible growth in that arena. And what we would like to see is that blue bar always below the orange bar. Being a math teacher, I looked into the background of this a little bit, and those last two bars, it first concerned me because I thought, oh, we did something that didn't quite work. But when I looked and thought about it, what happened is that the advanced category, the average student scored lower because we had more students in the advanced category. So when we were averaging 93% at the beginning of the school year, at the end of the summer school program, that number dropped to 90% because we had some students that went from proficient to advanced, and so we actually saw a little bit of a shift. So that's not necessarily a bad thing from what I looked at. And there's a slide later on that'll help you see that. So we're going to go through these a little bit quickly, but you have a hard copy of the PowerPoint, so you can look at it. Blue bar lower is ideal, but otherwise there's usually a two below. And the ones that were, I don't know if the right word is, but left behind had that average that dropped a little bit. And again, there is a slide, one of the last three pages, that will kind of show some of the growth that we did see. Okay, so this is the performance level increases. We had 29 students that increased one performance level. 4 students increased 2 performance levels. 84 stayed at the same level, but 54 of them increased their raw score. 12 students dropped one. 1 student dropped 2 performance levels. Would be curious, as you would probably also, there's usually a background story behind something like that. A great day on the first day of school and a bad day on the last day of school. It has been the case in the past. But we had about 70% improvement within the students in the English language arts. And then the math, we had really, really amazing results. 28 students increased 1, 7 students increased 2. 18 of the 23 that stayed at the same level increased their raw score, and then 2 students dropped 1 performance level. So it was just very exciting results on that case. We only had 7 students that didn't improve the raw score from the beginning of the year. And then this is the kind of a breakdown of percentages of students who took the ELA pretest and the ELA post-test. So I think what you can take out of this is that we went from 10% that were far below at the beginning of summer to 7% at the end of summer, and our advanced went from 2% to 4%. And that middle group, you kind of just saw probably 3 to 5 kids per group that just moved up a level as they went. And so they, in the basic level, 3 left, but 3 took their place. And so we had a fairly consistent group, but there was definite, as you saw before, definite growth in that area. And then the math was, again, just the huge one. 13% far below to begin with and only 2% at the end of the summer. And the advanced category went from 2% at the beginning to 11% at the end. Proficient doubled. Again, basic stayed the same because of that domino effect on that one. And that's the end of that part of the slideshow. Little anecdotal thing. Or do you have a question first?
Well, I just wanted to ask over what how long was summer school?
It was 28 days total, so about 5 weeks of the actual summer school program.
So this was all accomplished with these kids?
Yeah, actually, no, in the elementary it was 19 days. Secondary had 28 days, and this was all the elementary data. So they had 19 days to really get in. And one of the theories is that when you if a kid doesn't go to summer school and they're at this kind of a level in the lower end of things, they tend to lose a lot of their reading strategies and a lot of their comprehension stuff. And then as this, you know, so they start this next school year for reading levels, you know, they drop 3, 4, 5, 6 reading levels. If they go to a summer school program, at the very least, they maintain. And then, if they do drop, they may drop 2 levels instead of 6. And so, in those 19 days, it's a good chunk of time for them to keep their skills kind of honed. And then they can start the school year off on a better foot.
Right. Okay, thank you very much.
And then on a little anecdotal note, I had Dr. Prater come out and visit, and he had asked one of the classes, how do you like summer school? Scale of 1 to 10. And I think every kid but one said 7 or 8 or 9. They were just excited about being there. And Dr. Prater had asked the one student, why only a 5? He goes, I started at a 1. So at that point, I thought, okay, just that's a successful summer school. Lori Johnson is a teacher at Los Ranchos Elementary, and she did a first grade summer school program. And she had the students write a story about themselves, find pictures on the internet, and then put together a little photo story of them. So I would like to show you 3 of those that she put together.
It is important because it helps me get exercise, and it is football. I also like the summer because I can go and play.
Having me here and for being able to show a little bit of the summer school program that we put together this last summer. Any further questions?
Yes. Can you summarize any unmet needs that you and your team recognize that we might guide us in future summer school programs?
It seems like summer school ended a week ago. We had a little bit of break, and then the school year started up. That's one of the things that we're going to be analyzing in the next couple months. January is when I start my work up again. So between January and June is when we really focus in on the needs that we're going to look at. So in the next few months, I'll just be brainstorming. But I'll get back to you between January, February on something like that.
I'm curious as to whether it's possible, and this may be a question for Dr. Prater and Mr. Robinette, whether we can, based on the growth that was demonstrated over summer school, then follow these same kids throughout the school year and see if it continues to reap rewards or if that's being too picky here. But I'd be curious to follow these students who were, especially those who were recommended to attend summer school, and see if their growth continues through the school year.
That's one of the nice things we were able to do is because we have all of this data now in Data Director, each of the teachers has access to it, and it shows up that the kid did this kind of work at the summer school site. And so at the teacher level, they are for sure looking at how it's going because the teacher is the one that recommended the students in the first place. At a district level, it's absolutely doable. Between Darla and myself, we can look at this again in the next few months and see and look at their test results that they take during the school year, and again look at the end of year test at the end of the year.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
How was the daily attendance? Did you keep track of that, and did you add that into when you were looking at pre and post test scores and so forth?
We have that data available. I don't have it off the top of my head. On a typical day, we were probably running between 90 and 92% attendance. Again, it's one of those things where the kids like going to summer school. They do fun projects. It's a little different than a regular school year. The teachers are really excited about being there. Every one of them, was begging and choosing, please choose me to be a summer school teacher. Out of the teachers that we had, half of them were very seasoned veterans, and the other half were literally brand new teachers. And the young teachers are the ones, they take that advantage and they just go with it. And so the staffing that we were able to put together made the kids want to be in the seats because it was a fun place to be, and they learned. And like kids like this were able to do things that they maybe wouldn't have volunteered to do during a normal school year. Dr. Prater and I watched a middle school student present a math problem. There's no chance that he would have been comfortable enough to do that in a regular school year, but you get him in a group of his like-minded friends, and he was able to become a leader in the class. So because of that kind of thing, we see usually very high attendance rate on that.
Great. Thank you.
Okay.
Next we have Jackie Kirk-Martinez is going to come up and show you guys a little bit about the special ed program.
Hi. Thank you. Good evening, board. Sorry this looks this way, but you can read between the lines. I think it's the projector. Right, so extended school year is quite a bit different. I feel like I'm echoing too. It's quite a bit different than summer school. Extended school year students must meet a criteria in order to be eligible for extended school year. I'm not going to have you read this, especially looking like that. But the eligibility criteria is that a student must have a continuous, indefinite, disability for a prolonged period of time, must have an IEP, and the IEP team must agree that the student would regress so much during the summer that they wouldn't have enough recoupment capacity at the beginning of the school year over a period of time to be able to recoup what they have lost from June until the end of August. So it's an IEP team decision, including the parents. So that's how they become eligible for summer or extended school year. And it's not only just the class of its extended school year, it's what are the additional services that the student might need. So before we go into some of the hard data, I wanted to just show you some of the graphics, and I'm sorry they're turning out this way, but this is our preschool. We had four different preschool classes going this summer, and they were doing some block patterning. They were getting some of the social skills and interactions and puzzles. In our kindergarten class, our new teacher, Diane Duarte, with two of our students, a lot of sensory needs are also being accomplished here in our kindergarten class. First through third is at the top, and they're doing the zoophonics so that they don't lose those skills, because in all of the classes in elementary, whether it's general ed, special education, you'll see the zoophonics and their letters identification. Fourth through sixth grade, they're doing a math activity, so it becomes more of the curriculum-based standards. I'll talk to you a little bit about how they guide their instruction during the summer as well. And then during the summer, we also have an opportunity to work with the students, again, IEP-driven, students with autism who are in the general included program during the school year. They're working really hard on the academics and the core standards, and they're having to attend and focus and not have some of those self-STEM behaviors during the school year and really focus on the core curriculum. And we do have social clubs and social groups during the school year, but their time is spent so much learning about the academics that during the summer we have the opportunity to pull them into a like autism class with typical peers, and we have wonderful volunteers for the summer because we make this social group setting so fun that they want to come and volunteer, and they're actually the role models for the students with autism, and we teach them competition and how to be competitors while keeping their stress level down, while keeping their anxiety low. We give them a lot of skills that they can then return to the classroom in the fall and be able to have those playground skills, those competitions, play those things in the classroom with other typical peers. And it's been very successful. This is our third year in doing this. Here you'll see on the left some car races, and they built their cars. They had competition, and it was quite interesting how there was no winner, no loser, and they were high-fiving, and then they were switching cars and really interacting well together. And then at the end, there was a kickball competition with the two different classes. And at the end, it was really nice. Our new special day class teacher, Mr. Dale, he was one of the teachers, and he was out there interacting with them, and he says, "I didn't know I could be such a good coach and a social coach," and he was having them go by back and forth and doing the high five, good game, and some of the students hadn't ever experienced that. Okay, in our CELPA countywide, we have developed an extended school year packet that the teachers have guidelines to go from. How is a student eligible? What do we do? When's they're eligible? And this is a small version of what we have the teachers complete when we give them to the extended school year teachers, because a lot of our teachers don't teach during the summer. They take that time and take a break. So we have some new teachers. Instead of giving all of the teachers during the summer packets of IEPs and ask them to go through and pick out all of the goals and the accommodations and the services and how do the parents communicate and the behavior support plans, we have one document, and it may be front and back. We ask the teachers during the summer to choose the top really significant goals that the students might regress and cut and paste them onto the IEP, onto this document. We do a pre-ESY performance. How is the student doing presently at the end of June before they pass the paper on to or in transition the student to the new teacher during the summer? And then we do a post-ESY performance. That way we can track differently from how summer school is tracked with test scores. We're tracking their goals. And then any health or medical concerns, because we're not meeting with every single nurse and every single teacher for all of the students. Also, any other specialized equipment or accommodations or any reinforcements that are used. And then how do the parents communicate? What's their method of communication? Some like email, some like phone calls, some will come and pick them up every day. So that's something that is given to all the teachers instead of the thick packets of the IEPs. And this is the first year that we've completed this process, and the teacher's feedback was really positive. At the end of this, with the post-performance, all of the work samples, all of this form goes back to the teacher, and they're able to see how they did as well. So it's a good communication log between them. So in extended school year, you'll see the numbers according to the grade levels. You'll see that preschool, we have the most students requiring the extended school year service. Usually they're coming to us and they're just starting to gain those social skills, just starting to gain those communication skills. And if we were to take 10 weeks off, we don't know if we could maintain those. They would be able to maintain those at the beginning of the school year. We'd be starting over and losing some ground. And then in first grade, we see a little bit of a dip in kindergarten. That's also because we have low enrollment in kindergarten for our kindergarten special day class, and some of the preschool students go on to typical kindergarten. And then first grade, you see a jump. At the far right, you'll see that the put one hand over your eye. MF, it's the medically fragile, the PREPARE program, and the DeGroote home. They also receive services during the summer. And there was approximately 6 students in each of those classes. So for a total number of students in extended school year, there were 135 students. There were 16 teachers and 51 paraeducators. When we were doing the math this morning, it was about a 2-to-1 ratio. We had 18 classrooms, and that's because of the De Groot home consulted and shared a teacher with another classroom. And then also there were some students that required extended school year services during home instruction. So the data that was collected, we had 371 student goals were tracked throughout the 19 days. And it was a variety of goals through academic, social, emotional, behavior, a lot of communication goals. Because without communication, you can't get your needs and wants met, and you can't be successful in school. So how was the progress? The progress remained the same for 80 of the goals. And there's a lot of factors that go along with that, and that's really good that some of the more intensive classes, they maintained their skills with a four-hour day over 19 days. So that was 21% of the total 371 goals. But what was interesting is that 291 goals the students made progress towards, and that's 78%. So the teachers felt really good about that because they're not really sure about who these students are. They're just getting to know them. They're getting into the swing of things and finding out how to differentiate the curriculum because all of these goals are different. There's not one goal the same. So those 371 goals are all very different. And then this goes to our initiative one, of course, that we will achieve substantial academic gains with specific student populations, and this is one of them. Do you have any questions?
Well, thank you very much, Jackie.
Okay, thank you.
Let's move on to item number two, and that would be resolution number 021112, GAN limit calculations for 2010-11 and estimated calculations for 2011-12. Mrs. Lang.
Thank you. Most of you are probably pretty familiar with this. We report it every year, but for those of you who are not, the GAN limit is calculated annually as part of our unaudited actuals, but it's required that we report it separately as a resolution item for the purpose of identifying the actual appropriations limit for the year we're closing and the estimated appropriations for the next year. The GAN amendment was passed as part of Prop 4 in 1979 with the purpose of limiting the increase in government spending to no more than the changes in the CPI and population growth. And as you can see on our GAN limit form, on page 3, lines 11 and 12 show that our adjusted appropriations limit exceeds the district's appropriations subject to the limit, and therefore we have met our GAN limit for 10-11 and 11-12. Any questions?
Mr. Millar.
Julie, I noticed on page 1 of 3, our ADA seems short of our actual student numbers.
The 6,881?
And even adding in the charter school ADA. I thought we were up over 7,100
our enrollment is over 7,000, but our attendance is usually less
than that. It's ADA. That's where I didn't make the connection. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any other questions from board members? Is there anybody from the audience that would like to speak to this issue? Okay. Seeing none, we'll take this back for a vote. Is there somebody who'd like to make a resolution? Or would like to make the resolution? It's my motion, please.
I'll resolve to move the approval of resolution number 021112.
I'll second.
We have a motion by Mr. Buckman and a second by Mrs. Sheffer. Mrs. Holmes.
Mr. Buckman?
Yes.
Mrs. Sheffer?
Yes.
Mr. Unger?
Yes.
Mr. Millar?
Yes.
Mrs. Roger?
Yes.
Mr. Questenberry?
Yes.
Passes 6-0.
And then we'll move on to item number 3, adoption of 403B, Tax Sheltered Annuity Plan, and Governmental 457B, Deferred Compensation Plan, and Appointment of Third Party Administrator. Mr. Miller.
Thank you. The IRS code provides an opportunity for employees of qualifying governmental agencies to make contributions in a 403B tax-sheltered annuity. And administration has determined that one of the most efficient ways to administer a TSA, or tax-sheltered annuity, is to contract with a third-party administrator with knowledge of Internal Revenue Codes and expertise in dealing with investment options. Previously, Great American Benefit Administrator served as the third-party administrator. Staff now suggests the board assign the position of third-party administrator to Mid-America Plan Administrators, Inc. Attached is a resolution authorizing the district to establish compliance and administration procedures to ensure the district's voluntary retirement plans comply with state and federal guidelines, contract as third-party administrator, Mid-America Plan Administrators, Inc., to assist the district in meeting its responsibilities as plan sponsor, and require plan participants and investment option providers to adhere to the newly established procedures. There will be no cost to the district. Mid-America is a fee third-party administrator, and there could be fees involved for active participants. However, approximately 75% of the investment providers commonly used by our employees pay the third-party administrator fees on behalf of the participant.
Mr. Millar and then Mr. Quisenberry.
Russell, was the Great American Benefits Administrator, were they a fee-based TPA as well?
No, but they became one.
Ah, okay.
That is the basis behind which we are recommending the change.
Okay. And then the language that refers to the Mid-America plan administrators paying the investment fees in 75% of the cases, is that through a non-front-loaded investment vehicle, or do they actually, the employee picks a investment vehicle and then the TPA pays the actual upfront fees on it?
The investment vehicle pays the third-party administrator fees. For instance, there is a fee schedule for our new Mid-America plan administrators. And what they do is they contract with a large group of investment options, and some of them will pay the third-party administrator fee as part of their annual contribution.
Okay, and is that disclosed by the TPA to employees when they invest where there's an interest
involved?
Actually,
it's disclosed within the third-party administrator, theoretically, and with the investment option.
Okay. I would move approval of resolution.
I think we have. Oh. Yes.
Still make a motion.
You can make a motion.
You can.
But it may die from it. No. We'll remember that.
That's okay.
Well, Walter, you sort of asked my question, but I just want a little further clarification, and that is this is a change, the fee for fee is a change that's come about. You anticipated it that the Great American Benefit Administrators were going to do something similar.
And they were also going to take inactive account fees, which means that if you had chosen to stop your contributions, you were inactive. And in the past, they had just essentially ignored your account in the sense that they didn't attach fees to it. The big change for them was the inactive account fee structure that they were putting into place for employees who were not currently making contributions or managing their account actively.
Is this a trend overall for third-party administration? I know that prior ones didn't charge,
Over a 10-year period, yes, the trend is there. I think it is accelerating in the last couple of years with the different vehicles and the changes in investment strategies and the way the economy is going. I think that has become the trend that we can expect to see. All third-party administrators making fees upon the investment of their clients.
Thank you, Russ.
Okay, is there anybody from the audience that would like to speak to this? I have a question for you.
Yes, sir.
Russell, seeing nobody who'd like to speak. When we change plan administrators, sometimes the investment options that are offered to employees change as well. And I've got to say, that's a hassle for the employee, especially if you were on an investing your money through an approved bunch of group, and then it suddenly becomes a non-approved group, then you have to move all your money and decide what to do. Can you talk to me a little bit about that? Because I know I've been through that a couple of times, and it is a tremendous hassle each time.
Yeah. And as things develop, we may end up going through it. But in this particular case, Zook is our right. overall provider of guidance on these issues. Excuse me. And they have assured me that if there are any cases, they don't determine that there are any, but should any crop up, they will work in order to make that plan acceptable to Mid-America plan administrators as part of their group. So we are going to not guarantee it, but work hard to make it acceptable. If you're in one already and it's not adopted, we'll try to get it adopted. However, we don't make any guarantees about getting your choice adopted if it isn't currently a choice.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Quisenberry.
Just one other question. You've obviously evaluated or Zook did, evaluated the two. Do they also evaluate service, or is it just what is offered?
It's service across the board in all aspects, whether it's collecting fees or having customer service lines or accessibility. All of those aspects are taken into account. The reason that I really didn't have too many issues about changing to Mid-America on the basis of saving money was because Mid-America is currently the plan of choice for most of our neighboring districts in the county office. So they are the administrator. It's not like it's a new kid on the block. They've been involved for several years in the plans of our neighbors.
Thank you.
Okay, great. Mr. Millar, would you like to make a motion?
Thank you. Very kind of you. I move approval of Resolution 03-11-12, adoption of the 403B tax sheltered annuity plan and governmental 457B deferred compensation plan.
I'll second the motion.
Okay, it's been moved by Mr. Millar and seconded by Mr. Quisenberry. Any further discussion? Mrs. Holmes?
Mr. Millar?
Aye.
Mr. Quisenberry?
Aye.
Mrs. Roger?
Yes.
Mr. Unger?
Yes.
Mrs. Sheffer?
Yes.
Mr. Buckman?
Yes.
Passes 6-0.
Okay. We'll move on to item number 4, and I guess I get to present this item. And it's the discussion of clerk vacancy. As we all know, with the resignation of Mr. Angel, we now have a vacancy as clerk of the board. As you can see from the agenda item, we need to decide what to do about that. This is obviously no fiscal impact. The board has 6 meetings until we would do our reorganization in December. So we need to come to a decision on what do we want to do about this. And the way I've looked at this is I think we have a couple of choices. We can, as suggested, we can elect a clerk pro tempore. And if that's the case, then does the board want to make that choice or does the board want the president to make that choice? I will tell you that my preference is that if we choose somebody for the next 6 weeks or the next 6 meetings, that I think that should be the board's choice, not mine. The second thing I think we could do is we could rotate clerks. And, of course, as everybody knows, because this is how it works with us, there are president-clerk meetings. And so it's important, I think, for not only the president to meet with the superintendent, but I think it's important for the president and the clerk, and, as we all know, there's an additional person who can meet. If the board chose to go with a rotation, for example, what I would see is that everybody would get one turn at being clerk, and the way I would like to see that then is the responsibility for that would be that if you're clerk that week or the week or the next or the upcoming week, however we'd want to choose it, that would be your week to absolutely come to the president clerk meeting, as well as whoever else would want to come to that meeting. I'm going to open it up for discussion. I think we just need to choose what we want to do. So, Mr. Millar.
I'll jump right in there. I'm just visually stunned by the idea of rotating clerks. I actually think that's a good approach in view of just the limited number of meetings left. And it will expose some of our members who have not had the opportunity to do that. if you have had the opportunity to do that, could you donate your temporary clerk job to a eager person who might want to do it instead? Not that I would, but I also seriously think it's a good opportunity to get in a flow of meeting with the superintendent, in which I have been out of that flow for many months now because of business commitments. So that's kind of my thought.
Well, the way I would envision this working is that Mrs. Holmes would create a calendar, and you would all volunteer a certain date, and that would be your date. And I think that would be how I would think it would work. Mrs. Holmes, would you like to talk about that?
I'm foreseeing one issue because you have two board meetings a month, mm-hmm. but you have your weekly meeting weekly.
Right. Yes.
So given that you can have three board members mm-hmm. attend that meeting, mm-hmm. perhaps the clerk pro tem will attend and the incoming clerk
yes.
pro tem would attend this together
That's
with you. So
that
and then the following time
right.
the newer person would attend and the next one that's coming along would attend.
That's pretty much what I was thinking too, because obviously you want that person, those two people, to be involved for that time span. So I don't know. I put that out there as an idea, and what do the rest of you think? I don't know. I'll go around and just pull you. I don't know, Mr. Quisenberry, what's your preference?
Well, I've given some thought to this, but not a lot. Is the job such that it would benefit someone to be the clerk pro tem for the remaining time? Is there some benefit in establishing that relationship? Or, you know, that's me. That's basically my question. Is there some benefit from putting in that time rather than have it on a rotating basis, where it seems where a person might get, you know, one or two chances to meet rather than an extended period of time?
If in my opinion, having been through it, I don't think so. I think that the truth is there's not a lot to learn to be the clerk or the president. Got to tell you, but I think the value in it is being able to go to the president clerk meetings and then also to get experience helping run the meeting and the smooth flow of the meeting. And I will also tell you that I have an interest in having everybody participate in the leadership of the board, and I think this is a way that we can get people who might not know what that experience is like, that kind of experience. I think it's. I'll use you as an example. You haven't had that chance, and I think it would be a great thing for you to be able to come and do that. Just like I know Mrs. Roger has, but she doesn't come to the president clerk meetings, but her input's valued. I think for all of us to get that chance is really a good thing, especially given that structured opportunity then to meet with Dr. Prater too. I know Mrs. Sheffer's been coming, Mr. Buckman's been coming. I'm putting it out there. I like that, but it's kind of the board.
Thank you for your response.
Mrs. Roger, what do you think?
I think it's fine with me to rotate it around. I agree it will give people an opportunity to experience the clerk meetings. Oh, I just hit that term, I can't stand. The president clerk meetings, who have not yet had that opportunity. And there is valuable information and just sort of getting to know one another that goes on in those meetings. I could go either way on it, quite frankly.
I stand by my earlier comments, and
okay.
I concur with you on the complexity of the clerk job versus the extra time, you know, okay. to get a head start on it.
Mrs. Sheffer?
I like the idea of the rotation.
Okay. Mr. Buckman?
have to learn how to turn my microphone on. I have to agree with everybody. I think we really should have as many members of the board trained as possible. We had a situation where we had somebody step down. So.
Okay. So we have consensus. I don't believe we need to take a vote on this. So, Mrs. Holmes, can you coordinate the calendars for that? And we'll go forward. Do you want to take a volunteer right now, or do you want to do that?
Well, given Mr. Millar's earlier comment, are there any of you who wish to pass on this opportunity that I should leave out of the schedule?
I don't want to pass. I was just...
Okay.
Mrs. Roger, you have your light on.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm just neglectful.
Okay.
Then I will use my dartboard and come up with something.
Great. Thank you, as always. Let's move on to item number 5 then, selection of board subcommittee to review applications for appointment. Dr. Prater?
Well, as you know, we agreed to a special meeting next Tuesday, so a week from tonight, to select our new, our replacement for Phil Angel. And we agreed at the last meeting that we would select a subcommittee of trustees who would examine the questions for the interview process, as well as look at the protocols and make sure that that everything's in order for that evening. I can tell you that on your table, Ms. Holmes was able to compile all of the applicants. There are 7 applicants in total who wish to be considered for this. For this position or this appointment, and I would like to suggest that that you weigh in on the on whether or not to interview or consider all 7 applicants, and then that would be one less thing for the subcommittee to work on. But tonight's task here is to identify 2 or 3 board members who would be willing to look through this process, make sure it's all clear, especially with respect to the questions and the protocols for the 13th.
Okay. So the first really question is the board in consensus that we would interview all 7 potential candidates?
Yes.
Okay. All right. See, so that's the consensus. So then the next thing we need to do is have a board subcommittee of 3 people to review the questions and to call the questions and development questions. Do we have some volunteers for that? Mr. Quesenberry, Mr. Buckman? We need one more. Would you like to? Okay. Mrs. Sheffer, you volunteered. Okay, so we have a board subcommittee of Mr. Buckman, Mrs. Sheffer, and Mr. Quesenberry. That's it. We'll give you guys we'll have some fresh blood to decide these things. Okay, great. So the interviews will commence at 6 o'clock next Tuesday, the 13th. Are we doing them here? In this room. Okay, very good.
And the subcommittee is going to... come up with questions for the interview, and then we're going to, and the whole board will have a chance to review those prior after the subcommittee's initial work. And yes. Are we going to do the same thing we do where you have to read the same questions over and over again? Or?
You know, that's a good question. And is that the board's preference is to read the questions, or do you want one person to read the questions? You know, rotate through. Does anybody care?
I just don't want to ask the same question over and over again.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, I run out of creative inflections.
Okay. How about? Well, why doesn't the subcommittee?
You can rotate those. I mean,
we could definitely rotate questions.
There you go.
Okay. So we'll make that the subcommittee can decide on that as well. Okay. Sounds like a plan. Let's move on to item number 6. Board policy, administrative regulation on interdistrict transfer process. Mr. Miller and Mr. Robinette.
Nah, I'd rather sit here. Rick has the substance. We bring to you tonight a potential solution to a vexing problem that we've had for several years, and it's involved with interdistrict transfers. The district's position and procedures in the past has been essentially a blanket denial of all applicants from other districts to come into our district, and we have done that, and we've been consistent about it. And we justify that position on the basis of a couple of things. Number one is all of our money that we operate with is generated from within the boundaries of our district. And it's a property tax. It's the characteristic of who we are. And we don't get any state aid. And we don't take any contributions from our neighbors, if you will. The other aspect of this is we do very conservative and fiscally prudent approach to our staffing, class sizes, and programmatic issues, so that when we have a, let's say, an elementary school staff to 20 to 1, we do our best to load our classrooms to 20 to 1. And if we were to take interdistrict transfers, its potential exists and actually has occurred many times, not many, several times, whereby we've done our staffing to our maximum class size and then had somebody move in next door to the school but not been able to go to it because the classrooms are impacted. So there's a number of reasons why we do what we do with our interdistrict transfers. In the last several years, there is a law that's in existence that should a district such as us deny an interdistrict transfer, the parents of that request may appeal our decision to the County Office of Ed. The County Office of Ed acts as the source of last resort, essentially the Supreme Court of this issue. There are no appeals beyond the County Office of Ed. And this process has resulted in a growing trend for an imbalance, if you will, in the types and kinds of reversals that we see done by the county office. Up on the board, you'll see several years' statistics listed. And at the top is 2009-2010. We break it down by elementary, middle, and high school. And then we go across by neighboring district, making where that child lives inside the boundaries of which district. What you see, and let's just take 11-12. It's the third grouping down. We have three elementary requests for an interdistrict transfer. We have three middle schools, and we have 15 high schools. Of those 21 applicants to reverse our denial, 17 were essentially, we had our position reversed by the county office 17 times, and four times we were upheld in our denial of that. The districts, if you look across on the right-hand side, Tascadero had three, Coast Unified had eight, Lucia Mar had nine, and Santa Maria Bonita had one. I'm not sure why they got in there, but anyway, when you take a look at the two major districts, you have Coast Unified and Lucia Mar. And of the Coast Unified, almost all of them are eighth graders going into ninth grade living in Cayucas. It's a Cayucas issue with Coast Unified. Over the last 3 years, the bottom grouping has the measurements for the three-year totals. There's been 75 appeals of our denials. 60 of them have been reversed by the county office. 15 have been upheld. We're not getting a lot of cooperation in trying to uphold our own individual characteristics from the county office. As a result of that, we've had a meeting with the county office, and we've determined some steps, and Rick will talk about that in a moment. But there is a recognition that what we have isn't a local control issue anymore. It is something that the county office weighs in on for purposes that aren't necessarily in our interest, but which they feel, and this is to be fair, which they feel are in the interest of the students.
I'd love to hear what those are.
One of the interesting one of the interesting outcomes of an examination of all of these appeals is the kinds of excuses, if you will. I think that's the wrong word. The I apologize for the use of the word.
But compelling situations.
Yeah. The explanations that they use for wanting to come to our district. And there's was here on an inter-district transfer. Poor attendance and tardies caused us to deny his request. The husband works in Cuesta College and a nursing student, and they need to have family help them with the bus schedule. Some of them claim great mental distress by not being able to come here. All of those issues end up really weighing hard upon the County Office of Ed. And it's not within their purview or expertise to separate all of those different issues and make a great determination. So as I think all of us might tend to do, we find in favor of the children and allow what they want to happen. It doesn't serve our purposes, but it does serve the purposes of the children as the county office measures it. We are also in anticipation of having discussions with Coast Unified about the propensity of Cayucas residents to come to our schools. And there are currently, prior to this year, 24 Cayucas residents enrolled in attending Morbay High School.
Mr. Miller?
That
I'm sorry to interrupt.
Let me finish that one point before I lose it, because at my age, I might go away real quick.
I understand.
The Cayucas, now I see I'm already forgetting.
24 students.
Thank you. 24 Cayucas students attending Morbay High School equals at least a teacher. And if they are all clustered, or the majority of them are in one grade level, it is a teacher for math, it's a teacher for English, social studies, the core curriculum classes. And it does have an impact on our ability to offer a better program to our own students. Thank you.
Okay, and I just wonder, I have heard that, in fact, I heard it from the gentleman to my left, that there are...
he's looking to his right, but he doesn't
that
know.
He's heard, I heard that he heard, that there are a number of students attending... not even requesting inter-district transfers, but just attending on
bogus addresses.
Falsified
They are falsifying
addresses.
Their residence
and,
addresses.
And how do we investigate that or pursue that, or do we even
we
know where to
chosen,
begin with it?
We haven't chosen to pursue it at this point. It is an issue of significance, I believe, but it would require us to essentially attack a family and a student, and
true.
I don't know that we have ever discussed that whole issue. As an administrative decision, we screen as best we're capable. We've looked at addresses, we've looked at prior schools. We challenge them now, and we ask them to deliver specific information. But I'm sure that there are many that fall through the cracks or have a history of doing it.
When a student registers, do we ask them to provide a PG&E bill or something in their name
yes.
in our district?
Yes. And we do that at all grade levels, and then that follows the student through. One of the issues we don't do is that we assume that they still live where they said they lived when they came to the district. It's potential that they have moved from that area. And then when they move into our area, they have the ability to provide us with utility bills, even though they don't live at that particular address. That's the falsification.
Okay, so the problem may be deeper even than the...
than the inter-district transfers.
Exactly.
Right.
I must say, if I can interrupt, back in the day when I was an assistant principal at San Luis Obispo High School and Mary Matakovich was the principal, I frequently went knocking on doors to try to find whether students were falsifying addresses. And even with utility bills, we had a significant number of students who were living at their parents' place of business, you know, in the dentist's office or whatever. So there are ways to easily falsify addresses that would require some checking, and we do it occasionally. And I know that Jackie's coming up here because I think we've sent Chris Dowler on a couple of those missions.
Oh, yes,
but it
have.
Is it is, you know, tedious work and something that we haven't done a great deal of.
Okay.
If we're concerned about attendance, where there are some concerns from principals and there are some red flags, Chris has gone knocking on the doors or calling the parents and trying to meet with them at their home, at their residence, to make sure that they are lying their head on the pillow at night in our district. So not to be aggressive, assertive, but just to have that culture of care again to make sure that they are here and that we are keeping our services in our district for the students that we are responsible for.
One of the things we want to do tonight is not necessarily look into the fraudulently attending, but that could be an issue we would be prepared to address with you at a point in the future. What we really need to do is grab a hold of this relationship with the county office and see what we can do about the Cayucas, Lucia Mar to a certain extent, kind of relationship so it doesn't deteriorate on us. And in that viewpoint, Rick has some
I've got
plans.
A couple of questions,
yes.
First.
Cutthroat question?
Procedurally, who specifically at the County Office of Education reviews these denials?
I'm sorry, say it again, please.
It's the County Board of Education.
Yes, it is.
It's an open session at the Board of Education, okay. Unless it's requested to be closed session. But it's
and
the Board of Education.
What standards of review do they use?
That's a good question. And they have their set of standards. And one of the standards is that they believe each student should attend school in the district of its residence. That's their premier number one standard. Mm-hmm. But having gone to these meetings now for 6 or 7 in a row, and what I see is a board of genuinely upset individuals trying to do the best they can without all the training, knowledge, and background that they need in order to do this right. And what you're going to hear from Rick is our recognition of something we may be able to improve upon that would help them. I would not want to be in their position when the mother of an eighth grader comes up and says, you know, I can't care for my child unless it goes to Morro Bay High School for this reason. Boom, 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 boom. And how is that board able to determine the truth, the validity, the value of what is being said? And it tugs at their heartstrings. And these are really nice people. And they are just genuinely upset by the problems they're confronted.
Yeah, but they're really nice people spending our money.
True.
And, you know, the way the courts do that is there is a burden on the petitioner to present evidence that's compelling, that convinces an open-minded trier of fact as to what the circumstances are. But, I mean, I feel like we're being played. And I feel like they're taking the easy way out, and I think we have a responsibility, they being this county board, to not have our funds dissipated in situations where we're being overridden. And additionally, basic aid?
Yes.
Yeah, in some cases, like Lucia Mar is losing the funding. We're gaining the responsibility with no additional funding. I mean, it's kind of a lose-lose-lose, except a child gets to go to the school they want to go to. Having attended 12 schools during my childhood, I have less sympathy for that. And I turned out okay. So.
And you obviously weren't harmed by any of that.
So. I mean, I'm really bothered by this. It's almost a 14th Amendment due process violation on our part. They're affecting our property interest, our money, and there's no standard of review. There's no due process for us. I mean, we worry about due process in many other aspects of how we treat students and parents, but I don't feel like we're getting due process from
we
this.
We aren't, and that's the truth of the matter. But having gone and been through this process, I've tried several approaches with the board. I've given them documentation of our class sizes. I've given them documentation of our funding source, the costs of which. I've talked to them about our budgets and how they've dissipated to the state over the last several years. I've talked about all of those aspects. And it's not necessarily that they don't get it. It's just that they, as a collective body, have put forth habit, if you will, that they will approve and overturn our denials if certain conditions are met. And it has to do, you see, the parents have gotten this because almost every successful case brings a group of friends with them. Every successful case has some element of the mental benefit that the child is getting. Every successful case has something to pull on the heartstrings of those board members. We recognize our own shortfall in this, and we want to present something tonight to you that might help, and certainly if it doesn't help, we will have done everything we possibly can do, and then we will need to take more aggressive steps. But right now, we still want to work with the board, and Rick has some issues to talk to you about.
However,
I don't know about you. I did not bring my 3D glasses tonight, so I don't know how helpful the overhead it will be or the screen, so I apologize. Yeah, we recognize we're kind of losing on a couple fronts here. One, when we have an 80%, which is what over the last 3 years, 80% of our denials are overturned at the county level. That's not a good situation. And we also realize that the other kind of loser for us is that we're not taking probably an active enough role in the whole process, because we do, by and large, by practice, do blanket denials of inter-district transfers into our district. And purely economically. I mean, it's an economic decision for us that students reside someplace else. They're largely in revenue limit districts they would lose ADA for that district to come to us, and we have no economic benefit.
It sounds eminently logical.
Yes. However, if you look at your own board policy, and I'm not suggesting any changes to the board policy, it's nice and broad and nebulous and kind of meaningless, I suppose, that the board recognizes the district can serve students and the superintendent or designee may approve inter-district transfer agreements with other districts, may choose not to. And so I'm not suggesting doing anything there, because we don't want the board embroiled in this stuff. That's what you have us do. But we are suggesting that we make some changes to our own administrative regulations. And very simply, and Kim, if you can put that up there, but again, you don't really need to read through all that. I can probably describe our process. So what we are prepared to do, and we actually kind of had a test run today, because we, even though we haven't actualized these in our ARs, we had a situation where we thought, well, let's give it a shot here, which was to continue our practice of, in most cases, in 95% of the cases, doing blanket denials of transfers into our district from neighboring school districts. It just makes, again, like Mr. Millar says, logical sense. However, we want to give the families the opportunity to appeal to us, to appeal to our district, instead of having to fill out paperwork and go to an organization, a county, again, doing what they think is best, but having our district not involved in it at all, except to show up and kind of argue the case from our perspective. So what we'd like to do is have our denials, if a family chooses to appeal that, or if a parent or guardian chooses to appeal it, to request that appeal to be heard at our district level first. And by doing so, they can put the paperwork together. We've developed some forms that allow them to kind of fill out the reasons for it. We have within our own administrative regulations why we would or wouldn't consider inter-district transfers. And within, 10 working days, we would set up a committee that this family can appeal to. It would be made up of myself as the Assistant Superintendent of Ed Services, essentially, Chris Dowler, who is our Deputy Director of Student Support Services, and a site principal, so we get a site perspective, a school site perspective, and whether we rotate that principal or have somebody be on the committee for the course of a year, we can determine that. But we would allow the parent or guardian to submit their case in writing, but also come and submit live testimony, just as they would at the county, to argue their case, to explain why they believe their child or children should be allowed to attend in our district. We would have the opportunity to ask questions. Obviously, translation services would be provided if necessary. And then we would deliberate in private as a small committee and render a decision. And the decision may well be, thank you for all your information, but we are still denying the inter-district transfer. Or it may be that truly it is a compelling reason. There is some circumstances where it makes sense for us to allow the inter-district transfer to happen. In other words, you know, take some control of it. If we deny at that level, we'll let the family know, we'll put something in writing, we will prepare a small report, not only with the checklist of why under our own administrative regulations, but also just really our reasoning behind denying that transfer, and then they can go appeal to the county. So we're kind of making one more step in the process and trying to take a little more control. We believe that that may not only take some of the burden off the County Office of Education or the County Board to kind of hear everything for the first time, but we also think it will also bolster our case at the county level, that this is a group that has already been heard. They've already had their situation explained. And it might hopefully not have that 80% overturn rate that we've experienced in the last 3 years. So this is what we're suggesting for our ARs. We're certainly open to your suggestions about this. We have actually had a family that had gone to the county board because we did a blanket, denial of the inter-district transfer. We had met Mr. Miller, Dr. Prater, and myself met with Julian Crocker and his administrative assistant, Val Kraske, and we described the process that we were hoping to put in place. We were kind of working on putting it in place. We happened to have an inter-district transfer appeal case at the county office last Thursday, and their board got word that we were working on this, so they just sort of remanded it back to us and said, well, why don't you go back to San Luis Coastal and let them hear your appeal first, which was fine. So we actually did a test run through this today. So we actually met with a family, myself, Chris Dowler, Leslie O'Connor, principal at SLO High School, and we overturned our own denial. So this is one of those situations where, so I don't know if we're helping ourselves or not, really. But actually very, very compelling circumstances, and it actually made sense. So I don't think, from my experience, and I've also, like Mr. Miller, gone many times to the county and gone through this, sometimes I shake my head wondering why would they overturn that, but this happened to be a case where we ourselves made that decision. Anyway, we're not asking for board, I think it's an action discussion, but really want some input on it and just kind of get a sense, are we on the right track administratively to kind of take a little control of this, at least as a first step here ourselves.
And I'm just going to see if there's anybody from the public that would like to speak to this item. And seeing no one, I'll go to Mr. Millar and then Mrs. Sheffer.
And I think it's a good approach, and we need to do some sort of due process ourselves initially. Will we be creating a record?
Yes.
Okay, including the testimonial aspects of it, maybe, or at least and here's my thought. The county board is acting as a reviewing level court, yes, essentially, and you don't want stories changing between the initial review and then the subsequent review, and one of the ways you do that is maintain a record, mm-hmm, and obviously we would want to do it with as little expense as possible. We use a fairly inexpensive audio recording for expulsion hearings, and then maintaining documentary evidence that's submitted I think is important too. But I think it's a good approach, and it's better than punting, you know, saying no. And even though I do think philosophically we should be saying no. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for that. I think a tape recorder is a nice, easy thing to do, or an audio recorder.
Mrs. Sheffer?
Actually, I'm deferring to Mr. Buckman. His light came on before mine.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Sorry, just quick draw there. I think this is great. I have not heard of it anywhere else, and I'm wondering, this may end up being a great model for the rest of the state in situations where there's a lot of...
Let's not hope we have to model this. Right.
We have mystery shoppers. But the other thing I ask, would there be any complications with the new open enrollment law that came down where if you're coming from a low-performing school, you can pick any district in the state.
Yeah, we will have to comply with that those laws anyway. And even there's an economic argument, but we will certainly comply with those rules.
Okay.
And it shouldn't have any effect on the Allen Bill laws. We kind of looked at the things that are out there, and I think this will be a fine process for anything.
I think it's great.
I would point out, I guess I just want to be clear. I'm inclined to agree with Mr. Millar that we have an obligation to the students who live within our district, and we have and we want to fulfill that. We're working hard to fulfill that. When we allow students to come in from other districts, not only is there the financial cost of educating those children based upon the way we're funded, but we also have everything else that goes along with that. We have all the liabilities, if that student turns out to have difficulties, we could be having expulsion hearings for students who don't even live in our district and having to deal with that. If the student requires services above and beyond, special ed services, resources, beyond what just a more typical mainstream student requires, we're being asked to provide all of that as well. And I think that's a lot to ask.
So. And I think it's important to note, I appreciate that, and it's important to note that within our ARs we have established a policy because Ed Code is somewhat permissive in that once an inter-district attendance agreement is granted, Ed Code indicates that unless you have written language in your agreement that it has to be granted annually, it becomes a permanent thing. Well, we have that written language. And so even the ones that we approve ourselves or the county approves, we have language in our agreement that says every year they have to come back and essentially do the same thing if they live outside of our attendance. So hopefully even with those ones that either, get by us, I guess, if you could say, or the county overturns, we do have an annual process, unlike many where it just becomes once and then that's the way it is forever.
Yeah. I would just add to that there's also then if we're talking about families, then we have siblings. We could have, other children. It would be difficult to, I would almost think it would be difficult not to consider it sort of a grandfathered clause. If you allow one student, then as siblings come through, that the issue is compounded.
Yeah, it's interesting because the very case we listened to today was a family who had been in our school district literally for the last 9 years attending our schools, and had moved to the CMR area, and were not seeking inter-district transfers for their elementary students, realized those students are elementary, they're starting in a new school district, they should stay there, not move just because we're requesting this for high school students. So,
yeah, I agree with Mrs. Sheffer and Mr. Millar on general principles. I believe that our tax dollars, the constituents in our school district pay to educate our children, and that's where those funds should be going. But nothing is totally black and white, and there are extenuating circumstances sometimes. So, this is as a fair way as any that I can see to allow people to give voice to those circumstances and have our district review it. I agree with Walter that we need to have good record keeping and a recording, mm-hmm. because to my knowledge, and this is my ninth year on the board, we have never been overturned at the county office on an expulsion hearing. So I think that when they see the degree of care and the fair hearing that we give, I think I'm hopeful that they will overturn us much less.
Well, with your permission, we'd like to superintendent's, we always call something with the superintendent's name, superintendent's review committee a try for a year, and we will come back with data, and we'll see if it has an effect on our own actions, but certainly on the county's actions, which is what we're at this point most concerned about.
So looking at the board, do we have a consensus to go forward with this? Okay. Dr. Prater. Okay, let's move on to item number 7, proposed revisions to food service board policies. That would be board policy 3550, food service child nutrition program, 3551, food service operations cafeteria fund, 3553, free and reduced meal price meals. This item will be presented by Mr. Miller.
Thank you. CSBA, California School Boards Association, periodically provides recommendations for updating board policies and administrative regulations to ensure compliance with changing legislation. The attached policies have been updated in accordance with the latest CSBA recommendations. We've reviewed these at District Cabinet, and we forward them on to the board to consider proposed changes at this time and suggest any further revisions the board deems appropriate. There is no fiscal impact to be measured on these recommendations.
Is there anybody from the audience that would like to address the board on this item? Seeing none, I'll bring it back to the board. Board members have any questions or... Mr. Millar, and then Mr. Buckman.
Boy, I've just been a chatterbox tonight, haven't I? Did you just do them all in a group?
Yes.
Okay. On the 3553, any of those language changes impact that issue we discussed some months ago regarding the disaggregation of Title I for evaluative purposes?
No, it doesn't change the requirement for confidentiality.
Okay, and we had, I'm trying to remember, we were on the horns of a dilemma because of confidentiality, yet the desire to use some of the information. Is that situation still status quo and this doesn't affect it?
There's a competing interest for knowledge of that information versus the interpretation by the Department of Education about the ability to reveal it, and it's prevalent in all districts as the measurement of the socioeconomically disadvantaged families become prevalent in trying to improve your test scores. Knowledge of those individuals is deemed to be important by teachers and principals, people designing the actual measurement tests, yet the Department of Ed has determined that is not information that's necessary to be known, or that there's an overriding concern, which is privacy, keeping that privileged information.
And so the changes to 3553 are neutral on that situation?
Yes. If you look at that, I think that the confidentiality/release of records section really has no changes in it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I was going to start at the front, but on 3553, just as I looked up and just to tack on to Mr. Millar's comments, there is one place where this information is used. Parents have the right to opt out of it, and I think that's the Medi-Cal. Jackie, is that ring a bell? You can take free and reduced information and, sorry. Okay. So there... Okay.
I'm not aware of it. I didn't know
I'll send it down.
That there was any extenuating exception to that rule.
Yeah. Okay. Let me share it with you. Anyway, my question first would be on, I thought we might go through these in order. On 3550, on page 7.2, if we look at the second paragraph, the student or designee shall develop Superintendent or designee shall develop strategies designed to encourage the participation of students and parents and guardians. Is the AR going to cover a method for that to occur?
Yeah, it would have to.
Thank you. That was concise. Chris, are we going to go do all three at a time? So if I have questions on others?
I can't reveal
them. Why don't we go through all three, and then we'll see if the board wants to waive a second reading or if we want to do this again.
Okay. So I have one last question.
Sure. Please, go ahead.
Okay, thanks. Going back to Board Policy 3553, I had asked, and I don't know if you've had time to gather the information on that, just the free and reduced program just is of interest to me in lines with the economics and any stress that it's putting on our community. And I wondered if we had seen an increase.
And yes, we have. Thank you for preparing me for that question.
Yeah, you got it.
And I was able to gather up some data.
Good.
And what we have seen in the last, since 2007, 2008, our population of free and reduced meals represented 28% of our population of overall students. And 2010-11, that's risen to 34%. And I think that's a significant increase with our population and the type of jobs, the type of economy we have in our community. A 6% increase is rather a significant. It's never been 34%. The previous high was 29%. So over a 15-year period that we track the data. We're seeing an increase because probably the economics of our community.
Thank you. So we can go ahead and waive a second reading on this, or we can bring this back. Is there an interest from the board for go ahead and making motion, Mr. Quisenberry?
I move that we waive a second reading.
Okay. Second. So we have a motion to move the second reading. Any discussion? All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Okay. Opposed? Carries 5-0. Mrs. Roger has stepped away for a moment. So do we have a motion? Do you want us, Mrs. Holmes, would you like us to make a motion on each of these individually or as a group?
If your consensus is the same on all of those, I can record that as a single motion on all three policies.
Would somebody like to make a motion on this?
Did you know that was...
You just took that motion, so if you tell me that that's...
That was a motion.
We took a motion to waive the second reading.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Right.
Then do the same for approval.
I'll move approval of Board Policy 3550, 3551, and 3553 as amended.
I'll second that.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, we'll bring it back to the board for a vote. All in favor? Aye. Opposed? Carries 6-0. I'm sorry. Okay. I'm sorry. We have 5-4-1 abstention and no in opposition. Let's move forward then to item number 8, proposed revisions to Board Bylaw 9250, remuneration, reimbursement, and other benefits. Mr. Miller, again.
Thank you. This is a policy that CSBA also has recommended some updating on, and we've attached its Board Bylaw 9250. It has been updated in accordance with the latest CSBA recommendations. We reviewed it at the district cabinet level. I would like to state as an aside that most of the changes in here are driven by the new Medicare, the medical insurance laws is passed at the federal level. And so what we wanted to do was update in accordance with those, which have now become the law of the land. And we wanted to make sure that we were in accordance with that, as CSBA does. So here on page 8.2 are the beginnings of those changes.
Okay. Is there anybody from the public that would like to speak on this issue? Seeing no one, I'll bring it back to the board. Is there any discussion from board members on this? Seeing none, I'll bring it back to the board and query the board on whether we want to go ahead and waive the second reading on this. Is that the board's consensus?
Yes.
Okay, would somebody like to make a motion on this?
I move that we accept
we accept Board Bylaw 9250.
So we have a motion. Do we have a second?
Second.
Seconded by Mr. Millar. Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? Carries 6-0. Let's move on to item number 9, approval of unaudited year-end actual financial statement for 2010-2011. Mr. Miller and Ms. Lang.
Thank you. Tonight, we're presenting our 10-11 unaudited actuals financial report, along with some budget revisions that have occurred since the budget adoption in June. The unaudited actuals will be the basis for the upcoming audit that will occur later this month. And I am going to try to see if this is going to work. That's not too bad, I guess. Fortunately, all this information is on pages 9.1 through 9.3, and this is just sort of a condensed version. So quickly, I'll just go through the changes to the fund balances that occurred in 10-11. As you can see, our general fund beginning balance was about $22,535,000. Our revenues and transfers in were about $75 million, and our expenditures and transfers out were about $72 million, which increased our ending fund balance to about $25 million. Let's see if I can read this here. Whatever that says, 826 is what I think it says, which is an increase of about $3.3 million. And we'll go into some details of that on the next slide, if we can see it. Our adult ed fund, we started with $100. As you know, the revenues come in through the general fund now, so we transfer in only enough to cover the expenses, so we also ended the year with $100 balance in that fund. Cafeteria funded very well this year. They ended the year with over a $1 million balance. I don't know if you recall, but the two trucks that they purchased will come out of that fund. Those have not been reflected in that balance yet. So that's one reason for it being as high as it is. Deferred maintenance remained pretty consistent. I think it increased by about $20,000. Our other post-employment benefits, which is the GASB 45, we increased using a transfer from the general fund of $1 million. And the $44,608 is interest income from that. And you have a question?
I do, Mrs. Lang. Where do we sit now in terms of fully funding GASB?
I think in the Friday notes last week or the week before, we have a new actuarial, and our unfunded liability is now up to about $13 million. It's up from about $10.9 million. So we're getting closer, but it's getting further away.
So.
All right, thank you.
And just a reminder, I think that this Fund 20, which is the Special Reserve Fund for Post-Employment Benefits, we are required to put aside monies protecting our employees for the future and their retirement benefits. So this is a fund, if I'm not mistaken, that directly benefits our employees, that money that we're holding in trust for our employees. Is that not correct?
That is correct. That's
great.
To
thank
fund
you.
Their retirement benefits.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And aren't there a number of public entities across the country and in California that have gotten themselves in a lot of trouble because of their failure to fund these future?
I think especially right now, because I think that a lot of organizations haven't been able to fund their liability. Or if they have, like we are, they've had to use it for other things because of the economic crisis. Yeah. Our building fund, we don't receive a lot of revenue in there, so we're kind of spending that down. That's decreased about $300,000. Capital facilities, actually we received about $200,000 more in revenues this year than we did last year, which I'm hoping is a good economic sign. And we will be paying for the portables from that fund this year, and we started to last year also. The County School Facilities Fund is where we had our CTE grant, which funded the San Luis High School welding shop project. That has been completed now, and so there's a zero balance in there. Everything's been done. The Special Reserve for Capital Outlay is sort of self-explanatory. We have a reserve set aside for any emergency capital outlay items that we might need. The tax override is just a trickling in of tax levies that we get, and we transfer that balance out to the building fund when we get them. So that ended the year with a $2 balance. And then we have our debt service fund, which pays the Vicente lease portable. And I think that'll be done this year. As a matter of fact, I think October is our last payment on that. And that's money that comes in from the county, and then we pay it for the county.
Let's see how this looks.
Chris, a couple questions, and just real quick before we leave this. First of all, I had the opportunity to go over to the welding classroom today.
I've
it was absolutely awesome after talking to you.
Good.
On the Adult Education Fund 11, I don't know if we skipped over it, but there was a revenue there of almost $400,000. And my question is, what generates that revenue?
And the majority of that are fees that are collected for the adult ed classes. Okay. We had, I think, about $5,000. It was a little grant that came in, mm-hmm. and there's a little bit in interest, but the vast majority is fees that are collected.
Okay, so my follow-up is these are fees from classes that people sign up for. Do we have a mechanism in place where we try to identify classes that may be of interest in the community so that there's some possibility that we could actually use this as enhanced revenue?
I'm sure we do. I think Greg Kaufman might know the answer better than I would. Greg, I don't think he's here anymore.
I'll give Greg a call.
Well, I think the answer is yes, but you know, it's a tricky thing because in many respects we're kind of purposefully downsizing adult education in some areas because we cannot, you know, get enough fees to pay for courses. But there are circumstances and situations where it becomes profitable if the interest is there. So we have a kind of a mixed bag of things that don't quite pay for themselves but get close, things where we actually do make money in the courses, and others that are almost entirely costs for us. So, but Greg would have probably a better handle on that.
If I recall, last year we had some of our parent participation classes that didn't have enough enrollment to, help me out here, guys, to warrant a full-time teacher, and the teachers were willing to work a reduced...
Yeah, we have mechanisms in place with some of our adult school fee programs where the teachers can opt to keep teaching the class for lower rates of return, if you will, by shortening either the duration of the class or by literally cutting their own salary.
Wages.
For the amount of students that sign up.
Was it parent participation particularly that...
You know, I'm not.
Was,
I'm,
came up
I'm not
last
sure,
year.
Mrs. Roger, whether it was that or not, I'm not. I don't recall.
Mr. Miller, you're shaking your head. Do you remember?
The EO classes, I think. The parent participation always has a really nice, robust enrollment. I don't think it was that one. I think it was a couple of classes, and the ebb and the flow of the interest is a normal cycle that we go through with these classes. And we do evaluations every year. Every time we offer the class, we evaluate its past interest and whether it's increasing or decreasing, and determine whether it's economical to do it, especially now that the Adult Ed Fund is part of the general fund. So there's very little difference between the two. We want to make sure that it's profitable, that it's creating the revenues we expect it to, and we do the best we can to manage it as an ongoing program.
Okay, if we find that we have EL classes, for example, that don't have the enrollment really that would justify the class, yet they provide great community benefit, and the teachers want to teach those classes with less compensation, would you let us know in a Friday packet? I'd be interested to find out about it.
Yeah, our family literacy classes, our EL, I think they're called CBET classes. Am I correct in that, Rita? Is that right? That we offer, and things like our GED preparation programs. Mm-hmm. We're not, keeping those classes necessarily on the basis of student enrollment. They seem to provide a value, and we're just doing them.
Okay. So. Thank you.
Okay. Continue on, Mrs. Lang.
Okay.
And while you're doing that, I just have to say, I think it's interesting that the interest on Fund 20 is about 0.5%, which is really pathetic. And
it is.
But
we're
putting it in safe things,
three.
I think.
Yeah. Okay, this is probably much easier to see in your agenda item on page 9.4.
This is our general fund summary, which kind of details what's gone on in our general fund and compares first interim, second interim, and our unaudited actuals. As you can see, our total revenues really were pretty consistent throughout the year. As a matter of fact, the difference between our second interim budget and our unaudited actuals was pretty close. Same with salaries and benefits. Those were all pretty close. As is pretty normal, our materials and supplies is where the budget dropped off. We always have the most budgeted there. That's where we have our holding accounts. Sites and departments can keep money there and use it for other purposes as they need to. So if they don't use it, then it just falls to the ending balance. And some of that is true of the 5,000 operations and other. Between the two, I think about $2.7 million of that belongs to categoricals as carryover. So that'll be budgeted next year as carryover in the categoricals, and we'll see that below. Our capital outlay increased a little bit. That's all those buses that we bought this year. And if you take that into consideration and then the transfers out to the other programs, that leaves us with that $3.3 million increase to our ending fund balance, bringing it up to about $25,826,000. And then, of course, from that, we need to subtract our components of the ending fund balance, which includes our 10% reserve for economic uncertainty. Our restricted ending balances went up by about $300,000, so that'll be our carryover for next year, as well as the flexible resource balances. I'm sorry, I didn't know if anybody could see that anyway, but there you go. No, that's nice color, though, I guess. So our flexible resource balances also, that's about a $1.1 million difference, and that'll be as carryover next year. And our unappropriated balance was actually pretty consistent throughout the year, too. It stayed at about $4.7 million. And then on pages 9.6 and 9.7, we have our budget transfer detail, which goes through the changes to our current year budget, 11-12 budget, that have occurred since budget adoption. And for the most part, it's pretty normal. Transfers in, transfers out. We do know about some of the basic aid reductions that are going to occur, and we have done our little switch with that. We already budgeted for those, so that's not a hit to the budget. And with that, I would be open to any other questions.
Okay, well, I'm going to go to the public first and see if there's anyone from the public that would like to speak to this item. And seeing no one, I'll bring it back to the board. Is there any board member that would like to speak to this item? Mr. Quisenberry.
I want to thank Russell and Julie for the information on the GASB. Is that at least the information provided by the actuarials that we have for the district? Is that also part of public record?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Just as a follow-up to Julie gave you the basic information on the actuarial, and we'll always be chasing our tail in a sense on the GASB 45 funding of the post-employment retirement benefits, because as we have an aging population and that population eventually retires, which we're going to see over the next 5 years, then the amount of retiree benefits is going to grow because of that. And what we end up seeing is a larger population of retirees that are living longer. And so the actuarial reports are required every 2 years. That's the point I wanted to make. So we will be adjusting our balances every 2 years. And for a period of time, maybe five more years, that balance will increase. It'll inch up. And it's $13 million now. It'll be $14 million in 2 years, et cetera. And then as retirees, I don't know how to say this nicely, but they pass on. Yeah, they graduate. Then those dollars are subtracted, and we'll see our actuarial unfunded liability decrease. Did I do well with that one, Walter?
The greatest cost on these post-retirement benefits is the time between retirement and when Medicare kicks in.
Exactly.
So we're covering that time. Are there any other costs beyond that are part of post-retirement benefits?
No, we
we bought out our retirement incentive, which is a post-retirement benefit, and our biggest ones are the medical, dental, vision that pass through to age 65 and then are taken over by Medicare, and we no longer cover that expenditure. The retirees are entitled to coverage on the basis of an active employee's benefits. So they can participate in the program just as if they were an active employee.
Thank you.
Okay. I don't see any other lights on. We'll take a motion here.
I'll move approval of the 2010-2011 unaudited financials.
A motion. Do we have a second?
I'll second.
Seconded by Mrs. Roger. Any further discussion? Okay. All in favor? Aye. Opposed? Carries 6-0. Let's move on to item number 10. Mrs. Delkiskamp.
Thank you. We're presenting an item that's kind of outside of our usual timeline, but we're doing this because it'll support number one, Initiative 10, which is providing career and college readiness opportunities for our students. And it's something that if we can act on it tonight and our schools can follow up, will affect the students we currently have. We have two courses, fashion design and advanced fashion design, that currently do not qualify for A to G CSU UC approval. But our school site staff has worked to revamp these two courses and have really made the course curriculum more rigorous. And what we are asking tonight is if you could approve these modified courses, then our school site staff would be able to seek UCCSU approval, in particular meeting the requirement F for visual and performing arts. And we could put this into place, and it would affect our current students for this year.
Is there anybody from the public that would like to speak to this item? And seeing no one, does the board have any discussion, or are we going straight for a motion here?
No, I have a question.
Sorry.
Rita, you're saying that it would affect students this year. How long does the approval process take from the UCCSU?
What I understand, it's usually a couple of weeks. We submit it. We have a final opportunity this month in September for this school year to get approval for courses, and so we would expect within a couple of weeks to hear from them.
Great, thanks.
And before I move for approval, I'd just like to mention this is, again, a fine example of how these prep classes and CTE classes help prepare students, and this goes so much further than just fashion design. As I look at this, it goes into chemistry because of the way the clothes drape and their ability to hold heat, and it really opens the doors much further beyond speaking English, beyond just fashion design, and it's wonderful. So I'd like to make a motion to approve these two classes.
We have a motion. We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All in favor? Aye. Opposed? Carries 6-0. Let's move on to the action consent agenda. Just let me know if you'd like any of these items pulled. Approval of certificated and classified personnel items. Approval to hire elementary class size instructional aides for 2011-12. Acceptance of donations. Disposition of surplus property. Approval of furniture and equipment requests. Approval of purchase orders. Approval of warrants and payroll. Approval of school-connected organizations, San Luis Obispo Agricultural Youth Booster Club. Okay. Is there any discussion from the audience on that? Seeing none, any board discussion on any of these other items? Seeing none, I'll take a motion.
I'll move approval of items 11, 12, 13, 14, 16, 17, and 18.
Okay. We have a motion. Do we have a second?
I'll second it.
Seconded by Mr. Quisenberry. Any further discussion? Okay, all in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Carries 6-0. Mr. Buckman, item 15.
Item 15, I just want to again point out that we are purchasing vehicles and ask Mr. Miller, I guess, are we continuing to look at alternative fuels as we buy these vehicles?
Well, we're going to look at, on our buses, we're looking at replacing it with CNG, compressed natural gas, and where appropriate, as Mr. Buckman has asked in the past, to look at some hybrids and other, maybe going to smaller size vehicles. In this particular case, what we're looking at is transporting food around the district in large quantities. So these particular vans make sense to have capacity over necessarily some sort of mileage issues. So that's why they're there.
Okay, then I had a question.
Yeah, Mrs. Roger?
I noticed that we're surplusing two vans and replacing one. Should we anticipate that another is coming?
Oh, on the surplus piece?
Mm-hmm.
Going back to the surplus column?
Right, we're surplusing two old vans.
Yeah.
With transmission problems, and then I see we have one that's one new one that we're replacing. I don't think it was food service.
I'm not sure how to answer that at this time. What we got is we excuse me, we had an accident and one of our vans was hit and totaled, and so we have to replace that, and that's number three on your list, the replacement van.
Okay.
In the food services department, we have two that we need to replace. I think this is one, and you'll see one more. Yeah. Oh, that's what you're talking about. Okay. Yes. So we will be replacing those two that you see on your surplus list. Thank you.
Okay. So these two are the two I see on my surplus list, or there will be another one coming downstream?
There will be another one coming.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So I'd like to make a motion to approve item 15.
Okay. It's been moved by Mr. Buckman, seconded by Mr. Quisenberry. Any further discussion on this item? Seeing none, I'll bring it back to the board. All in favor? Aye. Opposed? Carries 6-0. Let's move on to advanced agenda. As you've all noticed, it's a little bit different now. Dr. Prater has included the advanced agenda on the master planning calendar so that we can actually see what's being planned for when. So it should be in the back here. Behind the advanced agenda items, and you did not get one, Mr. Millar. Okay. All right. Is there anybody that would like to add any advanced agenda items? Mr. Buckman.
I don't want to add anything. I just want to compliment administration for this. It's going to make life a lot easier, and I'm glad that we added the advanced agenda items. Thank you.
Great. Okay. And then we'll go move on to item number 21, reports by board members. Does anybody have any reports they'd like to make? Mr. Buckman.
At the last meeting, I questioned some of the items on the milk contract, and I just wanted to mention that I did spend time with Sue Thurman. She's phenomenal. We've got a great, intelligent person. And Thursman, I'm sorry. And I did spend quite a bit of time. Great stuff going on there. Let's see. Sorry. I can't read my handwriting here. Did get through it. One of the things in visiting a lot of the schools back to school nights, one of the comments that was made, and I thought I'd share it, is that as concerns were coming up at the school sites, the comments were the district's response was wonderful, and so when it came to staffing or equipment, and it was just good to hear that. I just wanted to congratulate administration yet again.
Okay, Mr. Quisenberry.
I'll make this short. Visited Morro Bay a couple of times. Like to see my old colleagues. Mr. Andrus expressed his gratitude for the staffing there. Said opening the school went very well. Pacific Beach, had a chance to drop in at lunch. Missed Mr. Halfman, but got to talk to some of the teachers there and meet the new EL teacher there. And finally, Baywood, went to the back-to-school night, and I was impressed by Mr. Jennison's presentation and the size of the parent turnout. Very fine indeed. Thanks.
Mr. Millar.
I just want to thank Dr. Prater and staff for providing information in Friday packet on our testing protocol and security. I was not surprised to see that we have very effective comprehensive program in place, and I appreciate it.
Great. And I, too, was able to go to several back-to-school nights, Morro Bay High, San Luis High. I did get to go to the new teacher orientation staff development day, and it was really exciting to see all the new teachers. Great bunch of people. I did get to go to the Del Mar back-to-school night, and one of the things I just wanted to point out was Ms. Gould talked about replacements in the computer lab, and what they had then done is they're surplusing the old computers, and they're giving them to families in the community. And that's something the board's been asking about for a really long time, and I'm really glad to see that that's happening. So thank you very much. I don't think there's anything else, so we stand adjourned.